This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Now's the time to save 30% on wedding jewelry, only on BlueNile.com. Make sure your wedding ring is the one with your pick of diamond and lab-grown diamond bands, all hand-finished and graded for excellence. Or surprise her with something blue she'll love for life, like a stunning pair of sapphire earrings. Blue Nile's jewelry experts are available 24/7 to help, from fit questions to style advice. Right now, get up to 30% off at BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Ha! I take my shirt off. Ha! Work all day, hustle and pray. Got nowhere to go. Got to catch my shirt. My plantation shirt. My plantation shirt. My plantation shirt.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Shirtless Plantain Show, the Arsenal edition. This is your host, Dean, and we are here for the season review with a guest this time. And our guest is an alumnus of the Shirtless Plantain Show. Welcome back to James Benge of CBS Sports. Hi, James. How are you?
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me back. I guess it didn't go that badly wrong the first time, but we'll see if I can make it to the third.
Amen to that. Amen to that. And as usual, Coach is here. What's up, Coach?
About to head to the gym. So, yeah, guys, let's get this done. No, I'm joking.
And, of course, Gabby, the best of us.
Clearly. Clearly.
All right, James, you're the star of the show today. So we're going to pepper you with everything we can think of regarding the season that has just passed and maybe the one before that. I suppose we'll start with an easy one. You're an Arsenal fan too. What were your expectations going into the season? Like, I think most of us often wonder about how we're going to integrate new signings, and we had a bunch of those. What was your primary main concern as a fan? Like, what were you worried about?
I mean, in both sort of capacities, I suppose I wasn't really sure how much of what we'd seen last season with Arsenal, however you want to call it, in 22-23 was real. It was, you know, a lot of fans will deny this, and a lot of fans were quite defensive about this, but it was a weird season. It was a season where I think we all know now a few players were saving themselves for the World Cup before the tournament began, and then afterwards a fair few came back, you know, most notably Gabriel Jesus from an Arsenal perspective, came back and weren't quite the same player, or they were carrying injuries. They'd all just sort of been run into the ground. And I mean, although no season in the Premier League is normal, this is a bit more reflective of where the league is. And one of the things I was intrigued by was, were Arsenal going to be real? I mean, for me, you wanted to see a team that was in the hunt for the Premier League title, that showed they could be a potential contender for the Champions League. I think we knew in both those cases that you're probably not going to sort of take a leap first time, first running jump. And I mean, I think especially given the new signings that Arsenal made and the fact that we were looking at kind of open heart surgery on the midfield, I was quite skeptical whether Arsenal could actually compete all the way to the end for the Premier League title. So pleasantly surprised by that one, at least.
That's awesome. Coach, what you got?
Yeah, to be honest, yeah, I read your stuff quite regularly, and your predictions like stuck in my mind pretty much for the whole season, right? And I think, considering, I suppose, the fact that you predicted us to finish second, and then but then on the flip side, you predicted Gabby Jesus to be our top scorer with 22 goals. Like, I want to know what informed your confidence there, because
I will tell you for a fact, I wrote that prediction before I was aware that he required further knee surgery. And I believe I then wrote it before I went on holiday. Otherwise, I would have corrected it. I mean, I still think, and you know, I've said all throughout this season that if Gabriel Jesus is fit, he's one of the best number nines in the Premier League. I don't think there's anything unique about him that mean the fact that he misses big chances. That has to be the case going forward. But yes, some of our predictions age well. Some of them age poorly. I still have, within the work Slack, I still have the pride of being able to be the one that said that they thought Sheriff would take something from Real Madrid back in the Champions League. That's all I've got going for me. I've got a lot of bad takes, a lot of bad predictions. But that one time I said that Sheriff might do something against Real Madrid, it's a big boon.
Gabby.
Listen, I hear you on that. You missed me with the Jesus thing, but I understand why you wrote what you wrote. I agree, though. They hit all my predictions this year. My predictions were we were going to finish second. We'd push City till the last day, and we did. But we'd be just short, which we were, unfortunately. And I had no idea what was going to happen with, like, the goal scorers. I figured it was going to be Martinelli, if I'm being real. Martinelli or Saka, I figured they'd step up again. At Champions League, I said I think we'd get to a quarterfinals, which we did. I didn't think we'd get to the semifinals. I would love it if we had. But I also thought we were going to finish with a trophy. I figured we would finish with at least one, like a FA Cup or a Carabao Cup, which we did not get, which is unfortunate as well.
Yeah, but can I mean, just a word on the Carabao Cup in particular. I know the FA Cup matters to Arsenal, but I just don't think of it as in any way an accurate sort of reflection of a club and what they're capable of. You know, even Chelsea have improved a lot in the last few months, but if they'd won the EFL Cup, would that have made their season any better, really? Maybe not.
No. I think it's just it's trophy logic for a lot of people. It's just, oh, if we get a trophy in the season, at least we can sing about that, and you guys can't sing about it. It's just, you can ask United fans, they won the Carabao Cup last year. Would they have taken that over our season? They'll lie to you and tell you yes, but we all know
they'll lie.
What the answer is. I suppose, not last season, 22-23, the World Cup year, Arsenal's response to setbacks and losses, you know, were varied throughout the season. I mean, we lost to Man City, then we beat Aston Villa 4-2 the next game kind of thing. This season, I feel as if, especially in the first half, while we didn't have that many setbacks, when we did, I didn't feel the same as I did last year, where it was, I wonder if we're going to go on a bad run kind of thing. And the one bad run we did, I feel like, probably cost us the season. Do you think there was like an onus on the team, well, from Arteta on the team, to really try to make sure that these are just singular blips and we go on a run straight afterwards? Or was it just a function of, I suppose, fatigue and just, I suppose, some of our tactics being found out and having to readjust again?
Well, in terms of making sure that the runs stop, I was sort of, this is more dates back to 21-22, doesn't it? When we, I mean, I can never get the dates right, but when we remember that Arsenal tended to lose in bunches. And I think that there was an awful lot of work done within the coaching staff then to just sort of almost, I mean, they consulted with other coaches, sports psychologists, all those sorts, just to understand what they needed to do to pull this team out of a negative headspace. They work really hard on that. I mean, you guys have seen what they're like on All or Nothing. It gives you a real sense of how Arteta motivates his players. And I think there's also one thing that I don't know exactly where it's come from, but I know that Arsenal always make sure their players are very conscious of when they're running into a team that took points from them last time, that beat them. Doesn't always work, you know, sometimes you get an Aston Villa, but this is now a team I think that's very effective at sort of motivating itself, that holds grudges as well a little bit. And I was sort of saying on the show with Charles earlier that I really wouldn't want to be Fulham or Aston Villa running into Arsenal next season, because this is a sort of a team that really does remember when it feels like it's been hard done by. Same thing happened against Newcastle as well. They just came out of the block and absolutely walloped them because they really didn't like how they'd been treated at St James's Park. So there has been a real conscious effort to get out of that. Like you say, there was that one run, but that was tired minds, especially at Craven Cottage. And that aside, that was probably the only bad, like, dreadful game Arsenal played all season. There were some off games, but like the only one where you go almost from start to finish, they were atrocious.
Very well said, James. Our first league defeat happened at Newcastle, and you mentioned that during your last answer. The goal was controversial. Three different points where VAR could have disallowed it. They chose not to. Then Arteta went on what a lot of people have described as a rant after the game. And
it was.
He had to answer to an desgracia and all that. He had to answer to an FA charge afterwards, and he did get lucky. That said, would you view that game and the aftermath as sort of like the turning point for Arsenal as a club when it comes to the criticism about the amount of emotion involved in our games? So I feel as if there's a before that and after that. I think Mikel kind of grew from that point, if you want to view it that way. I like the spike in Mikel personally.
I mean, that's quite an interesting point because I think they were still getting critiques about emotion after beating Liverpool at the Emirates, weren't they? But I mean, I do also see it certainly was the moment that they concluded that maybe the referee chat had served its purpose. You know, Arsenal had been speaking to PGMOL in the summer. I think one of the things they really emphasised was how often big, heavy, early tackles on them were going unpunished. Of course, Mikel Arteta had his own issues with refereeing to an extent with VAR. They're not, you know, they're not one of these clubs that is so vocal in its distaste for VAR as a whole. And look, when that statement came out the day after, which an awful lot of people criticised, I think that, I mean, that state, this purpose of that statement was to show Arteta, really, not even the fans, although it helped there, but or even the wider media, it was to show Arteta that Arsenal will back him to the hilt when he makes these cases. I think in the end, the reason that FA charge didn't stick is kind of people thought he had a point, that it was a bit, or not necessarily that he had a point, but they could at least understand where he was coming from. His language was quite measured and precise, and I believe there was I'd have to go back digging exactly what he said was a disgrace, but he was very clear it was not the refereeing, it was the systems, and I think there was an acceptance that some of those systems weren't up to scratch, and you know, that's been apparent all season long. PGMOL do actually, when clubs go to them, they do quite often say, we understand where you're coming from. And of course, like, you know, if we go into the VAR conversation now, they will say, look, you know, we know that you're frustrated by how long offsides are taking. Let us get semi-automated offside through the door before you decide whether you want to kick out VAR. But I think almost having that point where it all bubbles over, it just means there's not much more to say now. Like, what more can Arteta say about referees? And it is true that he's just stopped. He's just eased up on that a little bit. I think he's made his point, and I guess also how many big refereeing calls have there been to talk about since? I actually can't remember any.
Do you know what? Speaking of refs, because we had our fair share of decisions go for us and against us, namely in the Champions League. What would be your overall? And I know me and Gabby spoke about this before, actually. But what would be your overall assessment of our Champions League return? You know, first time in 7 years, like the entire, I suppose, campaign.
Oh, I think in the end, I mean, the most important thing from it was that they got the whole not winning a knockout tie monkey off their back. That matters. And I think they showed against the Bayern Munich team that were better than they were getting credit for at the time, that they can go toe to toe. It also showed to me that European experience is something very real. The way that stood out for me, this was really interesting. I love the stuff Nicolas Jova does at set pieces. It's so innovative. It's really creative. I know people there's been lots of stuff saying they don't work that much on it, but they always find a trick in their bag, something in their bag they can pull out to really disrupt a specific opponent. You know, whether that's using Ben White to set the screens on the goalkeeper, whether they're it's, you know, mass rush to the near post. They know what they can do from what they learned in the summer, what they learned in Dubai. They know what they can do to upset every opponent. But in the Champions League, I think they never quite got around the idea that things like what White was doing on goalkeepers was just officials there will blow a foul every single time. I think White committed 4 or 5 fouls from corners and free kicks in the Champions League, the sort you'd never see in the Premier League. I think things like that is when we talk about, you know, not having European experience, I think that's where it really shines through. I don't know why they didn't sort of stamp that out quicker, because it was driving me mad in the second leg against Bayern that you just kept seeing White fouling at free kicks or someone else fouling at free kicks. But like, to me, that's the lack of experience shining through. I don't think it was a depth issue. I think in the end, sometimes it's sort of ball doesn't go in the net, and that's what decides things. I suppose the frustrating thing is if they got past Bayern Munich, I don't necessarily think there would be anything stopping them winning the whole thing. I think they would have beaten Real Madrid, which sucks. I know.
Really? That's an interesting take, because I do not think that we would have beaten Real Madrid. I think we could have beaten Bayern.
I think the badge on the shirt would have intimidated, because I mean, it clearly intimidates every other team they play. It intimidates PSG, and they have played Real Madrid God knows how many times. But I think Arsenal were playing at a higher level. I think at that moment when the quarterfinal started, they were the best team in the world. And I think they had such a solid defence that what they wouldn't have done is sort of given up the slightly silly goals. I mean, I know that Madrid can beat you other ways, that something can happen. Vinicius could cook, but I mean, he wouldn't have found it as easy against Ben White as he did against Joshua Kimmich, would he? Yeah. I think they would have matched up really well with Madrid. We shall never know. And obviously, if they'd beaten Madrid, they would have beaten anyone on the other half of the draw. I think it'll come.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah, I wanted it at Wembley.
I would have loved us to go to Wembley again this year. I think that you were right about the experience with getting to Arsenal. The lack of experience in Champions League, lack of experience in European competitions has always gotten to us. It happened in the Europa League the year before. But I also agree that we do match up well with Real Madrid. I think that a team like Real Madrid, they're so top-tier echelon. No one would expect us to win that. And I think I don't necessarily disagree that we would have matched up well with them. It would have been close. Granted, the Bayern game was close too. But my question is, do you think – I don't think it's lack of experience, but do you think that the way that we talk about Arsenal being emotional – that previous experiences and us holding grudges, do you think that came into play against our game against Bayern? The tie against Bayern, us having played them multiple times and multiple ties and lost spectacularly. Do you think that played on their minds a little bit? I mean, it is what it is.
I really never got the sense it did. I suppose the one thing, I don't think like the history with Bayern played on their mind, but I do think there was a moment when Ben White missed, the sense I got was Arsenal's immediate response was, holy shit, we could win this. And they got in their heads a bit about that. Like for 20 minutes, they were blowing Bayern away. And I think then a couple of lucky, well, not lucky breaks, Bayern execute really well off sloppy Arsenal decision-making, which doesn't happen very often. And I think maybe in that moment, they were a bit too in their heads. I don't necessarily think that is about the 5-1s and all that stuff. Because I think so few, you know, I mean, of course, like within the Arsenal staff that I know, there are people that will remember that very well. But like, you know, the people in the stadium, there's been more turnover there. Hardly anyone from the playing squad, I mean, the only person from the playing squad who'd remember it was Arteta, and he hardly ever played in those games. And so if he doesn't bring it up, it's sort of like, is it really going to play on the minds of people that weren't there? But I do think that how well it went at the start made Arsenal react in a strange way. I don't think they went for the throat in the way they might in the Premier League. I think it took them back a bit that they were better than the, what were they then, 11 straight Bundesliga champions. I think they were a bit surprised how much better they were, which is not ideal. As a football team, if you're better than the opposition, you really need to be able to react to it better than Arsenal did in that game.
I think a part of it is probably just seeing Eric Dier on the other side of the pitch thinking, oh crap, no, we actually are just better than these guys. And, you know, it's like you don't know what to do yourself after that. I've been there before. I suppose, like, we're going into, like, the, you know, coming up to Christmas and whatnot, and we've qualified for the Champions League and whatever, and then we've had that run. We know what happened in the second half of this season. Do you think Arteta, I suppose, took lessons from how easily we qualified from our group, or I suppose the losses in December, you know, what helped push us on in the second half of the season, essentially? Do you reckon it was lessons learned from that run, or just, you know, lessons learned from how good we can actually be?
I guess, I mean, when I ask people around Arsenal, I think they were really, nearly all of them just say back, well, they weren't that bad in December. They had one bad game. Like, if you play that West Ham game 10 times, Arsenal win it 9. Mm-hmm. I know it feels like it's been said so often that it's facile to say, like, Dubai helped. Mm. I think at the very least it sort of fostered a little bit more, not togetherness. I think maybe it just made Arsenal players have a bit of fun together. Mm. You know, we all know what a bit of winter sun can do for you. And I think players were maybe thinking, God, I really don't want to spend the however many days, 17 or whatever days it is off, doing another training camp. But really, they just sort of enjoyed their time together. And, you know, one thing these players and Arteta and everyone always hammers home is there's such a bond in this squad. Mm. And I think that's only got deepened. And frankly, I think it's only deepened. It will have only deepened in the last few days as well, because I think, you know, they're a group that care for each other. I'm trying to remember who it was who said that. And I can't, but I saw it somewhere by a sort of ex-pro who was around the squad a bit and said, you know, there are a lot of dressing rooms where the players are just not that tight and they can still be successful. But this Arsenal team is different, and there is a real connection there. I don't want to go into all the stuff about wives and girlfriends as well, because it's just, yeah.
We've heard enough of that, to be honest.
Some people are friends with each other. But because I almost think it's more about this big organic grouping, because that's so hard to find it. I mean, maybe it's because I've been watching a lot of it of late, but it almost makes me think of The Office, the American Office, where it is almost just a sort of collective organism where, you know, they've been thrust together by circumstances, but they just actually seem to be a group of young men that really do care about each other. I might be wrong there. They might hate each other, but I've not heard that.
I want to follow up on the Dubai bit. I think it was after Dubai. I hope my memory isn't failing me here, that Declan Rice started taking set pieces. And I've read somewhere, don't know where, maybe your articles, maybe The Athletic, who knows. But I've read that Arteta was aware before he asked the club to put the money down on Declan Rice that he could be useful from set pieces. So my question, if you have the answer, is what took so long? Was this just a matter of Gabriel Martinelli falling out of form and allowing room for someone else to do something new on the team? Or was this something very deliberate that was discovered during their time in the sun in Dubai?
I don't think it was ever the plan for Rice to take corners and free kicks or to be the first taker. I think actually if you go and look back at November, December, Trossard and Martinelli are just taking them quite badly. The delivery was hit. My memory is that Trossard had a really bad run of just hitting the first defender every time. So they needed someone with the right foot. They really like the corners that fly into between the 6-yard box and the penalty spot, or even into the 6-yard box. It just suits the players they have and the height of the height advantage they have. So Rice did take them at West Ham a bit in his final season. I mean, like, I think some people sort of over-index that. I when he started taking them in that in those games after Dubai, the one that I really remember was the one where Gabriel scored twice against who? Palace?
Yeah.
Palace, yes. Well, the game against Palace, yeah. I just started watching all of Rice's free kicks he took at, and corners he took at West Ham. And it was okay. But, you know, you only need to be okay when you've got West Ham players to aim at to get a few assists. I don't think he got that many or created that much. But yeah, it was about freshening it up, really. And the other thing I heard was that one of the things they saw about Rice is he's so effective at stopping counters that, you know, if he's taking a set piece, he is at least then in a position once he's taken it to drift back. And I think if you go and watch them, you'll see he tends when he takes them to sort of gravitate back towards midfield so that, you know, if the ball gets booted clear, who else? There's no one better in the Premier League than Rice at sort of snuffing out those counters. I don't know if you guys saw the one against Everton. It was absolutely brilliant. Sort of 4-2 by Everton.
4-2.
Yeah, 4-2. He always comes out of nowhere and just gets
it's so good. Well, I mean, seriously, I can't believe how good that guy is.
I actually want to double down on this free kick thing. Do you, because we've been watching Arsenal for a long time, but it's just, in my mind, because we were talking about Santi Cazorla before this, I'm thinking about people that, like, specifically are free kick specialists. Do you think Arsenal have a lack of free kick specialists? Because we tend to rotate. It's Martin Odegaard, it's Martinelli, it's Trossard, it's Saka, it's Declan Rice.
But I mean, I suppose they're a good... Do you mean like a sort of shooting free kick? Because I think Odegaard takes them quite well. I wonder if they're such infrequent opportunities, especially for Arsenal. I mean, this is me thinking out loud now. How many prime position free kicks do Arsenal get? I don't feel like it's many. I think because they do so much of their work around the corners of the box, they tend not to get fouled in shooting positions. Just that this is entirely a theory that's come up off the top of my head right now. But and then if that doesn't happen, you just don't see Odegaard going all James Ward-Prowse. I mean, I think he's got an all right record, but is it that? It's just a guess.
I have a theory. A lot of the time when a particular player gets in that position and does get fouled by the letter of the law isn't applied. We all know who you're talking about here. It just doesn't happen, basically. For you know, so I can count on, I suppose, both my hands and feet how many times a season Saka goes through in that coming in, and then the referee just literally, it's almost automatic. Referee's just like this every time, telling him to get up. Like it's ridiculous. But speaking of Saka, and I suppose he's partner on the right, Ben White's evolution as a footballer, because that's the best way I can describe it. I think it's one of the most interesting things I've seen, not just because I'm an Arsenal fan, but just in general. He's 6'1", 6'2". That's, you know, primarily brought in as a centre-back, played his first full season as a centre-back, and has now turned into one of the best full-backs in the world, right? And it's not just because he's very comfortable on the ball and can see a pass. It's because of his decision-making. It's because of his actual technique. Do you think he was a surprise to Arteta in terms of how good he is, or do you think it was just... I suppose Arteta always knew he was waiting for the right time to phase him into this, because when he's been playing this way, Zinchenko, I wouldn't say he's redundant, but we haven't needed somebody else out to come out from the back for the ball as much because of Ben White now.
I think it's more about continually testing White in a positive way. I think he responds well to being challenged on the football pitch. And I mean, I please don't talk about England.
I love that joke.
I won't talk about the England stuff though, because it's so much of that just seems to be stupid, especially the way people talk about White. He does, and I think to an extent it's, you know, the right back thing was supposed to be, oh well, actually what we're going to do is form a back three, and White will really just be a centre back, and when Zinchenko inverts in year one, and he shows he can do that, and then part of it becomes, okay, well, you know, when we're really dominating, Ben, why don't you, you'll, you know, feel free to bomb on. And he starts to do that maybe later in that second, his second season at the club, his first year out of defence. I know that like Arsenal were very ready to just play him at centre back. So, I mean, so yeah, when Partey briefly and quite unsuccessfully inverts, inverted that run of games, you know, that had been, you know, Arsenal with view there was, we'll probably play White because we want Saliba as the central centre back that steps forward more and really dominates position, possession, and then that changes because of Partey's injury and it doesn't really work. As for the inverting by White, I think some of that is just they were a little bit out of options and it made life easier for Kivior, and Arteta was very conscious that Kivior just, it was not a role he was ready for yet, and White has been working in this system and working on that inversion because they get all their fullbacks to do it in training. So he was ready to jump in and, God, he was very good at it. It's funny that we almost haven't seen since Tomiyasu came back in, and I've been really impressed by Tomiyasu's inversion. But the joy of White now is you have every fullback you need in a squad in one fullback. You know, he can be the touchline hugger. He can be the inverter. He can be the third centre back. It's crazy. It's crazy how good he is. He's brilliant.
I mean, he said it before. Ben, I think Ben said that. There's that quote by Ben that I forgot who he's speaking to. He was talking about what Arteta expects from you as a fullback. Yeah. And he was like, he expects you to be a midfielder, a center back, a fullback, like a winger.
Yeah.
And he's all of those things.
Yeah. And by all accounts, he's just really embraced every single challenge that's been hurled his way by Arteta. And, you know, in a different squad, I look at him and say, like, it would be a different sort of leadership, but you could see him being a different sort of Arsenal captain for a different squad if you didn't have Ødegaard and Rice. I would really like that. And it's such a shame that the rest of the, even when, like, you know, you go to Arsenal now and all the sort of big names from the media are there, and I don't want to criticize fellow professionals at all, and I'm not, but it does feel like the broader discourse on Ben White is so far behind what the player is. And I think a lot of other Arsenal players, it has caught up. Everyone doesn't talk about Ødegaard as a promising talent now. They talk about him as one of the best players in the world. But with White, it's still like, oh, he'd be a good fullback option for England. It's sort of like, no, I think Kyle Walker's brilliant, but Ben White probably should be England starting right back at the Euros. And it's so,
I'm glad
strange
he's not.
To
so.
Not.
That's it. Yeah, I was going to say, Ben needs a rest.
It's Ødegaard as well. And
every week playing with Saka, you know, like, it's the most illogical thing I can think of. Like, your starting right winger plays with who should be your starting right back, and we're not, England is not taking advantage of that. Well, thankfully, I'm Nigerian, so I don't care.
Yes, listen, I'm always praying for England's downfall. I'm sorry,
You get this wrong. Like, we could, in this country right now, we might have an election where we get rid of, we might have Glastonbury one weekend. The following Thursday, we get rid of the Tories. Then we win our Euro quarterfinal. It will be bedlam. It will be carnage. I can't wait.
And I will be locked in my house, not partaking. okay. So look, I am a huge fan of beating Liverpool, right? They're like probably the one team in the top four where it's not really about hate or anything like that. I just have a lot of Liverpool supporting friends. So the banter afterwards is just the best. My dad's a Liverpool fan as well. Like, it's just the best. I think leading up to that game, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know, was Newcastle before? I think Newcastle was before that actually, but we had a lot of push on social media, right? I think on Newcastle game, Getz launched his album, you know, he did the whole halftime show, and then he did the whole promo and stuff like that. I suppose I want to know is, like, how much of that comes from Arteta? And it's like, I suppose, do you think it's Arteta doing a bit too much, or do you think it's been a good move? Personally, for me, I love it. I love the more you engage the fans, especially fans that are not in the stadium. I think it's probably going to serve as a as a marker, more teams are probably going to take are going to try.
Do you mean like the pre-Liverpool video thing?
Yeah, pre-Liverpool video. The you know, now like they're doing like the three pictures of like and one bold word across it with like a footballer there, like a Saka and a Gabriel and whatnot.
Yeah, brave. Yeah, you know, strength, whatever.
Yeah,
I love it.
He certainly the Liverpool video, and there have been videos since. I don't have like a list of them in front of me, but he said he wanted that. I believe he saw the cup before it went out, emphasized the sort of message he wanted about how important it would be to get this ground rocking, probably with maybe the exception of Porto, best atmosphere at Emirates I've seen this season. He really sees the value. I again, something I've talked about a lot. What he understands is that he can shape a story about Arsenal that, because it, almost in the writing of that story and the creation of this communal thing, it becomes more likely to happen. I mean, that was really apparent in his final presser, his final appearance at the Emirates Stadium, where those words, I don't know about this one, but they felt like he'd readied those words. It was more of a speech he'd learned than something he was saying off the cuff. But I think he has talked most Arsenal supporters into believing that Arsenal are going to win the Premier League. And that in and of itself is just the marginal gain that makes his players and his fans all believe it's happening. And they all start acting like it's going to happen. And that, you know, it becomes this virtuous cycle. So yeah, that hype video, he was involved in that.
Had his fingerprints all over him, honestly.
It did. You can sort of tell when he's, I don't know. Do you know, did you see the sort of black and white one that was, so I don't know if that's him, and I haven't asked because people were like, you know, the guys at Arsenal were so busy sorting out so many things that they knew probably wouldn't be needed for Monday that unfortunately, obviously, they never got to put into action. My suspicion is, I mean, if not, it felt very Arteta-ish, the sort of believe video. My only thing that I was like, oh, I don't know if it is because, you know, if I was like really involved in that, I'd be like, well, don't have a shot of me last. It feels weird. But yeah, you see this, you know, they talk so much. It's, I know it feels like talk, but they talk so much about one club and everyone in the club contributing in whatever way they can to Arsenal and Arsenal women winning the biggest prizes. That, you know, that shines through in him getting involved in what the social team do. Although we should say he doesn't do the lineup graphics, which everyone always seems to think are some sort of like hint as to formation. It's like, no.
They think he's that meme of a young thug in the studio.
Oh yeah, just literally.
You never know social media. Gabby, you had a question about Kai Havertz.
Oh, Kai. I'm the president of the Kai Brigade, just so you know. But which moment do you think was most important for Kai during the season? Was it the penalty at Bournemouth? Was it the energy of his performance at St. James Park? Was it something else entirely?
That's a really good question, because I don't think it came that early. I mean, certainly not that penalty. I think that he really enjoyed the Newcastle games, but especially the second one, the 4-1 win. And I would struggle to remember where he's... I wish I knew now off the top of my head where his first game up front was. But yeah, there was a really sort of sheepish reaction to the chant. And do you remember when that chant felt like it was a bit risky, thinking Kai Havertz scores again? I was like, oof, you know, let's not take anything for granted. The Brentford game as well was massive. Oh, yeah. But even within that, that Brentford game was sort of the moment that Havertz actualized what Arsenal had bought Havertz for. And it was sort of nothing like what became the Havertz that everyone says now is sort of one of the best signings of the season and would be Arsenal signing of the season if they hadn't got Declan Rice half price. But what I know for a fact is he left Chelsea because he didn't want to be a number nine anymore. And he wanted to go to a team that wasn't going to play him as a number nine anymore. So I would love to sort of, and I don't understand, but I would love to understand what clicked about playing as a number nine for Mikel Arteta, because he really enjoys it. He loves the duels. He loves you know, battling. He loves being the hold-up guy and feels empowered to do more than just play with his back to goal. But it wasn't what he wanted. He wanted the opposite. I don't know what it is that made him so happy to do that job. I'm sure it helps being in a winning team, a stable environment, because he found his time at Chelsea really trying. I wish I understood, but it's one of these sort of strange circumstances, isn't it? A team that didn't want him as a nine, a player that didn't want to be a nine, and he's an amazing nine.
Yeah.
He is.
I'll touch on that, what you just said. Like, I think he enjoys playing as a nine here, not just because we're good. Obviously, we're good. But it's just that they seem, that camaraderie between the players, I think, for me personally, his standout moment was that same James Park performance. Yeah. It's the way there's a false narrative around Arsenal where people are constantly calling us soft. They're constantly getting called soft, emotional. They can't get stuck in, can't do a rainy day Stoke or whatever. And I think that same James Park, like when Kai came out, even though he was not playing well at that time, he was one of the main players getting stuck in.
Yeah.
And even that, I think it was, I can't remember if it was the first half or the second half, when he does that tackle on the sideline, and the whole entire crowd stands up and they're screaming at the refs to give him a yellow card, send him off. He wasn't the only one standing there. His teammates came up to to battle for him. And I think that is something he did not have at Chelsea. Personally, I think that's what it was. I think that's why he fights for them. I think he fights for people who fight for him. People are constantly talking about Arteta maybe being a person that people want to run through a brick wall for. That's what Kai is showing with his performances.
Yeah, Arteta is basically Vin Diesel at this point.
Family.
That's family shit. It's working, though. We only have James for another couple minutes, and we had a bunch of listeners.
I could go a little longer.
Okay.
Oh, okay, perfect. But I started this intro, so we'll just go to listener questions. Sorry. And if we have time afterwards, we'll get back to some of our questions. At River is Wild wanted to know, which of our lone players do you possibly see staying and being part of the team next year?
None.
Wow.
Have I forgotten one? This is where I realize, like Charles will tell you this as well, I'm so bad for sort of forgetting Arsenal players.
Out of sight, out of mind. That's fair.
Well, yeah. There are players that may well get sort of forced into the first team picture by default, and Kieran Tierney's on a good wage and has had, you can't rely on his fitness anymore. The harsh truth, what's the greatest predictor of future injuries, past injuries? Like, teams will see that it happened again at Sociedad and that he's an incredible talent, but you can't, so that they may struggle to move Tierney out, and they may have to, they thought they'd get 35 million for him.
Wow.
In the summer, and then they had to take a loan. It wouldn't surprise me if they have to do a deal they don't want to do or loan him out again. But yeah, I think, Sambi as well, I believe, has come out in the last few days and said he's expecting to leave. Nuno, I can't remember anyone else. There must be others.
It ain't happening.
No, love him, but no.
No, Sambi's gone too. I agree.
I love Sambi as well, man. Oh, then we've got Deji TNO and Warrow World. They want to know, and this is actually a question that it's been burning me as well. In terms of the pressure for Arteta to win a trophy, do you think 24-25 is the season where Edu and whoever else are Mikel, you've got to deliver one of the big ones this year? Or do you think it's more of a, just keep doing what you're doing. We made 89 points. Let's see if we can get more than that and see where we end up again.
Yeah, I know this sounds cliched, but the greatest pressure is going to come from Arteta.
Yeah.
Arsenal are, I can't speak for Josh or Edu or anyone like that, but I think they understand that the best avenue to winning a trophy will come with Mikel Arteta. Mm. There is no... I mean, we're seeing this right now with Chelsea and Chelsea, Man United, all the Bayern Munich, all these teams. They're just a no surefire coaches out there. And unless that changed, you know, unless Pep Guardiola was like, well, it only seems fair. And I mean, this is an entirely theoretical thing, but you know, there just isn't a coach out there that I would think that Arsenal would do what Liverpool did with Brendan Rodgers to do, you know, move on from Arteta. There's no surefire candidates out there. I think even, you know, the top level sort of Ancelotti's and guys like that, I think it's a good question whether they would fit this squad as well. So I think it's more likely to me that Arteta would one day just sort of feel like he couldn't get across the line than it is that Arsenal would say, no, you can't do it. Like, you know, it might change if they come like sixth, but we don't really see that happening, do we?
All right, well, I got the next question. This is from DG Kirkland. Do you think we will see any loan to buy options in future transfers like Raya?
So the Raya one was a very intriguing transfer that we still haven't got to the bottom of, because I've always said, what was to stop Arsenal from simply structuring the deal with a very, very low upfront fee and then paying the rest later on? They were quite conscious of FFP and one of the or PSR, and one of the things that sort of makes me think that, you know, they knew they were getting some money from the Champions League, but it was never a given when they were striking this deal for Raya how much that would be, and they committed a lot of money. But from a PSR perspective, Arsenal are still really well positioned. Their wage bill is around 50 to 55% of revenue, I believe, which is great as well for the next regime when that comes, but it won't be this summer, it'll be the summer after. So they're really well positioned for that. The Raya one is still strange and confusing, why they structured the deal specifically like that. But the truth is also that, like, this was like a market opportunity. He wasn't going to Bayern. He had always been, not just in Iñaki Caña, but Arteta's favoured goalkeeper that he thought they could acquire. So they just sort of went for it, and they went for it in a summer where they'd already gone for it on three big players. It was I think more of a spur of the moment thing. So, like, they might do that sort of thing if a comparable opportunity presents itself for a player they've always wanted. But, you know, the more and more you upgrade your squad, the harder it is to find those players. And then the harder it is to do a sort of loan to buy deal with the clubs.
That's fair. I've got one that a lot of people, I suppose, have been wondering. The biggest change you expect next season, I suppose, for us?
Do we sort of mean transfers, really?
Tactical.
Even though we don't
tactical and play
style. Oh, tactical.
Yeah, because obviously there's very obvious things that we've seen from, you know, 22, 23 to 23, 24. For example, the overemphasis even more to build from the right. The fact that, you know, we're not afraid to go long now because of Kai and stuff like that. And the fact that our midfield configuration, we haven't actually got a strongest midfield. We just know what we want from the midfield. And depending on the game, obviously, we cater to it. But I don't feel that there's a strongest Arsenal midfield at this present moment. So, yeah, what do you think happens tactically and from a play style?
Well, so I suppose that's the interesting, like, kind of when I frame it in transfers, it's sort of like you kind of want to see a finished squad to know. That's a really good question that I feel like I don't necessarily have a clear answer to. But I think one of the things that stood out to me when Arteta made me wonder about how Arsenal will look next season was when Arteta spoke about more bite. And he's used the word bite a lot in the last few months. And I think Arsenal are sort of at the stage now where they need to think about how within a, well, for one thing, it's sort of drifting from a 2-3-5 to a 3-2-5 to a 2-3-5 in attack. Does that become more too, especially against teams they should beat, does it become, do they, how do they find an extra body in the front line, whether that's a fullback, whether that is, you know, almost a sort of, you know, how Rodri with City this season has sort of almost played directly behind the front line. Mm-hmm. So it's a sort of 2-2-1-5. Yeah. I think when Arteta talks about bite, I think he will be thinking, how can I get more players in the penalty area? Because Arsenal are still in open play. They're not quite as intimidating as much as they're the high scorers and all that. You know, if you look at like open play XG, they're still not quite putting the pressure on that Liverpool do, that City do. And I think he will be looking for, how can I get this sixth body around the penalty area? I can't see that that would come from fullback. I thought it was really interesting that you had almost a double inversion on the final day. Once Timber came in to the 11, you had Timber Tomiyasu inverted with Partey. And I think if whoever replaces Thomas Partey at the base of the midfield, which is what I think will probably happen.
I'm hoping for that, seriously.
I think it's more likely that I'm praying than, for it. Than yeah. Rice is the six and you get another eight, because Rice has looked a good eight.
Yeah.
This is that speculation. I don't know that for sure.
Yeah.
That six moves a bit further forward. That's what I would be super intrigued to see happening, because you get someone that's a bit more rangy than Partey. And it becomes a 2-2-1-5. But that's, I've not thought about this at great length, but I remember thinking in the last few minutes against Everton when City were 3-1 up, and I was like, Arteta's probably looking at stuff for next season now, really, isn't he? Like, he would never say it.
Yeah.
And I did think, I was like, really, okay, double inversion. Mm-hmm. Get the six further forward. Might be completely wrong, because absolutely no one thought that he was going to invert Partey from right back properly, even though he did it late last season before last.
So I wanted to touch on the City game. Not that I don't have much tactical analysis on it, but the way that it's been viewed, the narrative that has been going around in the media about how that one point that draw at the Etihad had killed us rather than the games that we've lost. What do you think about specifically Rodri's like comments of calling us cowards, not wanting to go out for the win?
I love it when players say things like that, first of all, but it's bollocks. I mean, for starters, like, everyone seems to forget that if Trossard takes a better touch, Arsenal win that game. But also, you know, you don't set up your team to go to the Etihad to win 4-3. You set up your team to go to the Etihad to win 1-0. And Arsenal did that a bit poorly. They were quite poor in terms of their breakout stuff. But, you know, they played to win. They didn't park 9 men behind the ball at all times. They're just, it's quite difficult to counterattack against Man City. In hindsight, I don't even think in hindsight it was a wasted opportunity or anything like that. And I think in hindsight, at all times, I thought it would be foolish to, you know, if it's Football Manager, you would never flick the dial to very attacking.
No.
I think Arsenal would set their game plan to, again, I'm going to just do this in Football Manager terms. They set it to cautious. You know, they were playing to win the game, but they weren't going to be cavalier about it, because the 3 point to 1 point swing is just too significant. But they had chances. They crafted breakaway opportunities they should have done more with. And I think sometimes the thing with shot data, XG data, is it'll never pick up the sort of half breaks that didn't even result in a shot. And there were a few of them for Arsenal that day, as I remember.
I agree. ESR, right? Player that I love, genuinely. Just give it to me straight. What's it looking like for him? Because
really, I think, you know, the indications I have is that sort of his camp are really disappointed by how it's all gone. I mean, I forget the game now where he was man of the match, or Luton, kind of in the conversation for man of the match, Luton. And go and check how many minutes he played afterwards. Now, you know, Arteta can justify that decision comfortably in terms of his priority, which is winning the Premier League, and Arsenal went on to win loads of games after that. But, you know, I would expect Emile Smith Rowe to leave. Be very, very surprised if he doesn't, because he's also someone that you can get good money for. Yeah. Probably you could have got better money if you played him more all season long, but expecting him to leave, I don't necessarily know of the clubs at the moment that would go for it, because it's tight PSR wise. So yeah. Someone like Villa would have to sell to buy. Well, yeah. or under pressure to maximise. I don't know if they're fully at sell to buy, but you see what Emery's saying in public. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, Brighton's one to keep an eye on for him. I would say that. I know they've watched him in the past. So that's all I have at the moment. Obviously, they don't have a manager. And although the manager is not the be-all and end-all in recruitment, I'm certain they wouldn't want to make a big signing without knowing who's going to be coaching them.
I'm sick, coach. You messed the vibes up with that question. I'm so sick.
I'm not sick. I know. I feel terrible. But you know what? Before we let James go, let's try and get his nominations out. For example, I don't know, player of the season for Arsenal.
Rice, easy peasy. I think he should have won all the individual prizes as well.
Not mad at that.
City are more likely to have done what they did without Foden than Arsenal are without Rice.
Okay. I suppose performance of the season for the team. I have mine in my head, but
yeah, I think mine's a bit different. I thought it was a 1-0 win over City. One of the best, probably the best defensive performance I've ever seen from Arsenal.
Mm. Okay, mine was 4-1 against Newcastle, but yeah,
that was good. I was thinking the Liverpool win as well, the 3-1 win. I mean, that was fantastic. It would be between those two. I'll stick with the City win.
Okay.
Yeah, I like the 5-0 against Chelsea because I hate Chelsea.
I was going to say, that's my favorite. That was my cup final. I needed to win that. I'm sorry.
I feel like listening back to the pods, which I'm not going to do because I produce them, but I feel as if that was the giddiest we were throughout the year. Like, we were so happy to play those guys. Like, it was so great.
Yeah, I did a post-match.
Just so you know, James, I told them I was not going to be on the pod if we lose that game. I was not going to be there. The vibes would be terrible. So.
Yeah. I was on my... what we call a mini moon, and we'd booked probably the nicest restaurant we'd ever been to. And I sat there the whole time just going, yeah, on the mini moon going, oh, Hannah, it's 4-0 now. Yeah, 4-0. And she was like, I really don't care. And I was like, oh, no, it's 5. Do you care now?
I suppose we've got two more then. So who would be your, biggest disappointment for the season?
Going back to what I said at the top of the show, yeah. I mean, I think you have to caveat it with his knees not being right all season. Okay. But Gabby Jesus, yeah, okay. Sorry.
Okay, and your biggest surprise?
I mean, it sort of feels like since the Bayern game, the fan base have gone a little bit cold on him, but when Jakub Kivior was good, he was really good.
Yeah.
Really good.
And like a sort of inverted left back. I didn't see that coming. That was, you know, I was not familiar with his game. I really liked what I saw from him. There are justifiable questions over his future, and I need to sort of dig into that. That's one of my jobs for the next few weeks. But, these Arsenal guys, they know talent when they see it.
Yeah.
So it seems. Thank you so much, James. We have to let you go now because things are always happening in our sport and you have to cover them.
Yeah.
You can find James on Twitter. We don't call it that other thing, at James Benge. That's JamesBenge. And on YouTube alongside Charles Watts on Inside Arsenal Extra Time with James Benge. And you can find us writing at cbssports.com. Thank you so much, James.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. Hope to see you again soon.
Take it.
That was lovely.
All right. That was fun. Yeah. We should have him back more often.
Yeah, for sure.
I feel terrible because I just realized that I didn't get him to shout Mitch out, and it's killing me. All I wanted to do today.
You should have started with it.
And Mitch, just so you're listening, he did verbatim say Mitch is great. I know. Yeah. It won't mean for much. Before he started recording, he literally said Mitch is great. I promise you, he did.
Yeah, so Mitch knows it now, and the whole world knows it now. Yeah. Guys, we covered quite a bit with James, but I feel like there's still more meat on the bone, if you will.
For sure.
Coach, you tend to have a lot of ideas in that big old head of yours. Pause. What are we talking about next?
I suppose I want to expand a bit more on what James mentioned about the tactical evolution for us, basically. And just, I suppose, being able to extrapolate what we've seen from the last two seasons and make predictions for the season coming up. Like, I personally never saw number five inverting at right back, first and second game of the season. I just never saw that happening, kind of thing. And I think if we're looking at stuff like that, Arteta is clearly looking for the thing he likes to mention the most, marginal gains, right? So he's probably thinking, I can get a lot more central progression if my right back can essentially evade pressure and punch it through the lines, kind of thing, along with my left back as well, So I think the next stage now is Timber getting back in the team for sure. He's going to body faint the opposition to death. But also, adding that extra body in our attack kind of thing, I don't think it's going to come from a fullback. I actually do think it's probably going to come from us going to market. And while obviously there's a bunch of names being touted around kind of thing, I honestly do believe heart of hearts, we're going to prioritise our game breaker, if you like, our new grenade as a wide attacker. And I think they're going to be probably fighting, Martinelli and whoever else on that left-hand side for it. That's what my heart is telling me.
Well said. I can't find much to disagree with because none of us know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
what I can guarantee is that you're going to be wrong, Nagu.
That's the thing. That's what's going to be so great, because everyone made all the predictions kind of thing, and he's like, oh, well, do you know what? I'm just going to play Havertz in midfield now, and we're going to suffer for it, and then I'm going to realise somewhere down the line that, let me just play him up front, and then we're all merry with it. So, yeah.
He will be back in midfield, so go ahead and prepare yourself for that. Gabby, transfers for the summer. I think, we never stop talking about this stuff because Fabrizio Romano is a hack. I can't Fabrizio, no beef. I ain't got no beef with that dude, man. Do your job. Get your coins, buddy. But now that the season's over and we're officially in silly season, a couple games left, obviously, that don't concern Arsenal. What are you hoping for, and what do you predict to happen in the market?
Well, Fabrizio, first of all, make the money, don't let the money make you. second of all, I think we make four signings. I'm gonna say that outright. I think we make four signings. We know the things that we need. Arteta knows the things that we need. We need a midfielder, you need a goalkeeper, a backup goalkeeper, because we're gonna sell Ramsdale. I'm sorry for anyone who's listening to this that wants us to keep him. We are not keeping Ramsdale.
That's gone. Not happening.
It's not happening. He's gone. So goalkeeper, midfielder. I think we get a striker. And then I also think we get a defender. I think the winger's going to be the thing that we miss out on. I think Jesus moves out to the wing. And I know you're making the face. That's not what I want.
No, that's what
I think we're going to do.
I can see it happening. That's why I'm making the face. I'm like, oh, you know what? Maybe
I can see it happening. I feel like it.
The face is pure Saka. I'm praying for you. That's basically it.
Listen, it just is what it is. I think we get, let's say, I think we get maybe two or three people that we're actually linked with now, like the Sescos, maybe a Bruno G or something like that, and a Hato. And I think the other two are people that we probably have never even heard of or weren't even linked with. It's going to be something like Tomiyasu or Kivior just came out of the blue. Because Arteta does at least one of those. Yeah, literally. A KO out of nowhere. That's what I think is going to happen.
Coach, you tend to have lots of ideas about transfers.
Marcus Rashford.
I want you to stake your reputation on one transfer you think will definitely happen. Just one. I just want you to. Actually, two transfers. I want two predictions from you. One person leaving for sure, yeah, and one person coming in.
Well, I'm going to cheat now and just say ESR is leaving. So there we go, because we just heard it.
Ooh, James already told us that.
No, I'm joking.
Oh, my God. No,
okay, all right. So, okay, genuinely, Cedric. Okay, all right.
You know what?
All right. Okay, not Cedric. Cedric is too easy. So,
It should be easier.
It should be easy. Yeah. Do you know what? I'm gonna say we're not extending him, and you know, he's run his race now. Number five will most likely go, I think. In terms of coming in, I'm sorry, Marcus Rashford. I'm just staking my reputation on it. Marcus Rashford.
Let me land
quickly. So he's gonna have the entire summer, right? He's gonna have the entire summer doing niche, right? He's gonna fly to Houston, he's gonna be in all the clubs, gonna do all these kind of things, he's gonna be bored out of his mind. But guess who, exactly, but guess he's probably gonna link up with LeBron again, go into the shop. but guess who also has nothing to do this summer? You know, a Lego head man in North London. You're gonna give Mikel Arteta 3 months, right, to woo someone? Yeah, you have completely sold the. It's the most obvious thing to me. Arteta is going to unsettle the shit out of this boy, and we're gonna get a bomb. It's gonna be an own bomb, and it's gonna be like Marcus Rashford in London to discuss deal with. I'm telling you guys, it's gonna happen, right?
I love how insane this is. This is what I was praying for when I answered the question. Good job.
Oh my god.
Gabby, do you think you can top that before we get out of here?
Oh my, I don't think anyone can top that. You're getting Rashford would be.
It's a big bomba. It's a big Fabrizio.
Rashford would be RVP in blood. Like genuinely. I can't imagine that even happening at
imagine.
All.
Imagine. In fact, but don't imagine because it's happening.
I mean, man. He would definitely learn how to track back under Lego head.
Yeah. He sure would. I mean, Arteta did say, he said, believe in more. We're going to get it. So we'll see.
I want to give a quick shout out to some of the folks that sent questions in that we didn't get to. Yeah. Tony Barber, Marcos Alvarez, Doctors Phil. You need to change your name, buddy. That shit is fucked up. Whatever. River is Wild, of course. DJ Kirkland, Deji, and Wireless World. Thank you so much for the questions. I think Habibi BL as well. We kind of skipped you.
Yeah.
We're hoping that if you had any questions, it got covered during the conversation with James and all the rest of it.
I've got loads as well, man. Like, I got loads in my group chat as well that we didn't get to.
I don't care about your loads, bro. Like, can you pause that shit? We almost made it out of here without you.
He needs to work off that energy at the gym.
Yeah.
Take your ass to the gym, bro. it's been a fantastic season with y'all. Thank you for rocking with us. If you're here and you're new because you follow James like Mitch did once upon a time, welcome. I hope you stay with us. We will be here for the 38 games next year. We'll probably have some stuff during the summer. We can't promise anything because we don't know what the schedules are just yet, but when there's news, we will try to cover it. And in that case, I think we're done here, folks. You know what to tell the people.
Got to catch my shoe. My plan to shoe.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.